May it please the Court, my name is Steve Neuberger, and together with my co-counsel, Rayanne Warner, I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, Lieutenant Colonel Keith Janowski. Now, in a nutshell, this appeal can be boiled down to the meaning of the word any, as found in 20 Delaware Code Section 905A. The phrase any employer, and also the phrase any provision of state or federal law. And an important thing in interpreting a statute like this, of course, is the standard of review, which is key. I would respectfully submit to the Court that Section 905 is a piece of remedial legislation which is to be liberally construed, but that does not end the matter of the standard of review. Because this is a piece of veterans legislation, and I realize that this is a matter of first impression for the state courts in general and for the Supreme Court in particular.
Does that trump the rules for interpreting or determining whether sovereign immunity exists?
No, it does not, Your Honor, but I believe it does go to the issue of how the – it's not trump the issue, but it does help shape how the phrase any should be interpreted in the context of making that determination. Now, the federal courts since the 1940s, including the Supreme Court, have had the opportunity to apply such a special standard of review to veterans legislation, beginning with the Selective Service and Training Act of 1940 and its predecessors during the Korean War and during the Vietnam War. Those courts have universally held that veterans legislation is to be liberally construed in favor of the veteran. Broadly construed is the phrase used by the Fourth Circuit in the Francis case, construed liberally in favor of the service members, the Third Circuit's most recent enunciation on this topic. And as the Federal Circuit said in 2007, any interpretive doubt is to be resolved in the veteran's favor. Now, I would respectfully submit to this court that it should look at that persuasive federal precedent and apply that same type of reasoning as to the standard of review to this Delaware veterans legislation. This legislation, particularly Section 905, has been on the books since I believe 1955, and Section 5105 has been on the books since 1941.
Your standard of review argument, is that pivotal to your position?
I don't think it is, but I think it certainly helps. I believe that the statute is clear on its face that it applies to any employer. I can get into that, but is it necessary? No, but is it helpful? Yes. Now, it's Hornbook law that the only way to waive sovereign immunity is for the General Assembly to do so in some type of a clear fashion. Now, this was the issue below, and this is the issue on appeal. What does the word any mean? As was argued below to the Superior Court, any means all or every one of a specified thing. And I will concede that the phrase any is not, or that the phrase any employer is not defined in the statute. Now, when it's not defined in the statute, I believe we are left to kick over to 1 Delaware Code, Section 303, which talks about that words, which explains that words and phrases shall be read with their context and shall be construed according to the common and approved usage of the English language. Now, to find the common and approved usage of the English language, this court regularly looks to various dictionaries, particularly Merriam-Webster's dictionary. So if one looks up the phrase any, which is the modifier of employer, of course. If one looks up the phrase any in Merriam-Webster's, it says every, used to indicate one selected without restriction, so every employer. It also says unmeasured or unlimited in amount, number, or extent. Once again, every employer.
Well, where do we go with the need to be explicit when the General Assembly intends to waive sovereign immunity? There's a long line of cases in various subject matter areas where this court said time and again that the General Assembly must be explicit when it waives sovereign immunity. And whether it's insurance coverage by the state, whether it's the Whistleblower Act, you name it, the interpretation says explicit. Where do we draw the line if we were to include phraseology like any employer and assume that that means the state? What happens to the rule of explicitness, if that is a word?
Your Honor, I believe that the rule remains the same. I believe by choosing the word any, that is as clear as the General Assembly could get for a statute of this type which does not have a definitional section. If this were part of a more comprehensive scheme like the whistleblower statute or like Title VII on the federal level or like USERRA on the federal level where there is a definition of just about every word therein.
Let me follow up on the Chief Justice's question. One way to look at our prior cases and the interaction between the statute and the Constitution is to prevent the state from inadvertently waiving sovereign immunity. And one could say in this case they used the word any, but they never thought it meant the state. And because if they wanted to permit the state to be sued, they would have been more specific. So the Constitution protects the state from inadvertently waiving sovereign immunity by selecting a word like any, because the Constitution says the waiver has to be explicit. So how do you respond to that suggested reading, you know, by your opponents of our prior cases?
I would explain it then if that it kicks over to our second merits argument, Your Honor, which is the in pari materia argument. By passing a statute which can be, as the court is questioning, which I would disagree with respectfully, but by use of the word any, you kick over to the under any provision of federal or state law. So you have to look at those provisions which do specifically say that states and public employees are covered.
Well, and I'm not suggesting an answer. We're looking for your help in how we sort this out, because clearly the state could have written a statute that said any private employer. They could have written a statute that said any public or private employer. They could have said any employer including the state. There are a lot of ways to do it that would have made it absolutely clear the state either was not waiving immunity or they were waiving immunity. My question is, how can we be clear that they understood the choice of the word any was a specific waiver of sovereign immunity?
I believe that it is twofold, Your Honor. First, you look at the definition of the word any. I believe that is when a word is used and there is some question about what it means, we do kick over to 1 Delaware Code Section 303. I believe that it is assumed that the General Assembly means what they say and that they know how to say what they mean. They may not always do it with the greatest amount of clarity. I believe if it said private employer or if it said public employer, this would be a lot easier for me on appeal, or a lot harder, as the case may be. But I believe that is the first level. You look at the dictionary definition, and one looks at the common usage. And the second level is the in pari materia argument. By explicitly referencing other statutes which have been on the books for even longer than Section 905, you look to what those statutes say. I believe that one of the canons of construction, and there are many, one of the canons of construction is that the legislature is presumed to be aware of other legislation on the topic. I believe that canon is even strengthened here because of the fact that Section 905 explicitly references other state and federal laws pertaining to reservist rights. When one looks to USERRA, the definitional section says it applies to states, and then state is even further defined, and it says that it applies to agencies and municipalities and whatnot. When one looks to Section 5105, it explicitly says that it covers public employees, employees of the state. I believe that there are two levels to answer the court's question, and those would be the primary and the secondary merits arguments that I've raised in my briefs.
We can, do you think, take judicial notice of the fact that there is at least a not insignificant number of Delaware state employees who are members of the National Guard or the Reserve?
Can we tell? I'm sorry.
I'm trying to phrase it delicately because I don't know the exact number. But we can take judicial notice of the fact that at the time this act passed, there were at least a not insignificant number of Delaware state employees who were members of the National Guard or the Reserve subject to being called to active duty, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, because I believe that Section 5105 was passed at some point during the beginning of World War II as to the United States entry, and Section 905 in the early 50s, which would be the Korean War. So, yes, Your Honor, I believe you can because... Well, yes, is the short answer to the question.
And in the last decade or so, when there's hugely important reliance on the National Guard and the Reserve for active duty purposes, the legislature hasn't seen fit to change the act, has it?
It has not, Your Honor. I know it has been amended several times, but that language has not been taken out of it.
I take it there's no synopsis or other aid in by way of legislative history to demonstrate an intention on sovereign immunity.
I have gone back to the legislative history. I had a law clerk down at the General Assembly for some time looking into these things. The closest we were able to find was a tape recording where it is discussed about the application of 5105 to public employers. but it says on its face that it applies to state employees.
But nothing on 905.
I was not able to find anything, no, Your Honor.
I realize that the sovereign immunity issue is the one that the trial court resolved the matter on, but there were other bases for the motion to dismiss, and I'd like to spend at least a minute or two on the actual merits of the claim. And where I'm coming from is this: if a person is put on probation, how can one serve a period of probation if they're not employed during that time?
Your Honor, I believe that the language of, well, I can address this on several levels, under the state law and also under the federal law, USERRA. And I realize we don't reach USERRA unless 905 applies. But under USERRA, Your Honor, it did not matter to Congress in passing the language of this, what is called in the case law, the escalator provision, which dates back to, I believe, the Tilton case during World War II, that the reservist or whoever the armed forces member, he steps back onto the escalator at the point he would have proceeded to had he not left the service of the state or the service of his employer for active duty.
Well, that works reasonably well when you're talking about benefits. If a year later you would have had higher pay or higher rank or whatever, then the law says you get it, even though you were gone during that time, right?
Certainly. Some types of benefits. It's not all benefits.
Okay, but what I'm having trouble with is how it is that when you are in a position where your continued employment is in jeopardy, that you manage to avoid that jeopardy by simply not being there, and you come back and it's as if you've served your period of probation. Where is that in the law?
In the law, I would direct the court to section 4311A, mm-hmm. which is the benefit of discrimination. I'm sorry, the benefit discrimination section of USERRA.
Right.
The definition of benefit.
How is that a discrimination?
It defines benefit of employment as any advantage, privilege, or status to be as any advantage, privilege, gain, or status. One looks to the definition of status, and in keeping with the fact that the federal courts have said that the term benefit of employment is to be given an expansive interpretation in keeping with the special federal standard of review, one looks to that, and is it an advantage of employment to be able to extinguish one's probationary period? I know one federal court has addressed this precise issue. It's the Schmalk case out of the Southern District of Ohio in 2003.
Right, I'm familiar with that case. Let's assume for the moment that we're not exactly persuaded by that case's reasoning.
Well, I would go to several other sections of USERRA. There are many. It is like the tax code in that sense. Each section has its own meaning. Each section has its own legal obligations which arise from it. I would go over to the reemployment position, section 4313, which also talks about, let me find it, that veterans would be placed in the position of employment in which the person would have been employed if the continuous service had not been interrupted. This is the escalator provision again. One looks to the definition of status, which, and also the definition of seniority. I think it meets both, but I would like to focus on the issue of status. It's not defined in USERRA, so one has to look it up again. I use Merriam-Webster's. And status is defined as a person's legal condition, the sum total of their duties and their liabilities. A plaintiff's status within the DSP at the time that he was called to active duty was he was on probation. I think that is certainly a liability of his employment. And the escalator provision would require that same probationary period continue to run just the way that other types of benefits or other types of status or seniority would continue to run while he is on active duty. I can make the same argument under the benefits section, Your Honor, the seniority benefits section, 4316A. I believe that the seniority benefits section is a little bit more complicated.
Okay, well, I'm happy to go through all the different sections, and certainly we will and have done that. What I'd like to have is some conceptual underpinning for why that makes sense. And, you know, please explain this to me, because from my perspective, if an employer says to an employee, listen, you've made some serious mistakes here, you're going to be put on probation for a specific period of time because during that time we want to satisfy ourselves that you can now carry out your responsibilities appropriately and not make any more mistakes.
Certainly.
And then the employee is no longer working there for good reasons, but is no longer working there during virtually the entire period that was set for probation. The employee comes back, and the employer is left in the position of, well, we haven't been able to determine whether you can satisfactorily perform your job as we had intended to watch for during this period of probation. But you're now off probation, and there's nothing we can do about it. Why does that, at a conceptual level, make sense?
Because that's the policy judgment of the legislature.
What legislature?
Of the U.S. Congress as to USERRA and as to the General Assembly as to the phrase terms and conditions of employment in 5105.
So you're asking us to conclude that the federal and state government wanted employers to lose the ability to supervise their employees and determine whether they are adequate employees, and that that was one of their policies.
I would say that they do not lose that ability, Your Honor. I would say that they continue to have that ability. Corporal Janowski could have been brought up on charges again for the search issue, which raises issues under the just cause provision for not giving him the refresher training mandated by the statute when he asked for it. They don't lose that ability. They just have to start that process again. Now, I see that I believe I'm into my rebuttal time, unless the court has
any. Not yet, but yellow light says
yellow
rebuttal
light.
Time.
I apologize. All right, well, then we, as to the just cause provision of USERRA, because Corporal Janowski was on active duty for, I believe it's greater than 180 days, he may not be discharged following his return to the DSP without a finding of just cause. I would call this the holy grail of civil rights litigation. Not many statutes have a just cause provision. Now, Corporal Janowski self-reported his initial search error in 2002, which resulted in his discipline. He was put on 1 year probation, and then he was activated for 12 months of active duty, training soldiers for certain types of combat-related jobs. When he returned from active duty, he asked for refresher training in the area of his search skills. I believe that search skills are a perishable skill. I know in the internal affairs proceeding, Corporal Janowski had an expert testify to that fact. He said, my search skills are rusty, and he asked for retraining. That training was not available to him at the police academy. He then went to a supervisor, asked for refresher training in his search skills. That was, again, not given to him because they just said it was not available. We'll give you that training once we have the opportunity. Then they sent him back out onto the road, and he was ultimately disciplined and ultimately fired because he missed an item during his search. I would submit that that is not just and that is not fair, which normally really doesn't matter in civil rights law, but here we have a provision requiring just cause. And term cause, in keeping with the standard of review and is recognized by the Federal District Court in the of Colorado in the Duarte case in 2005, it says that the cause provision must be construed and applied narrowly to the benefit of the service member. This is why there are multiple sections of the statute which do apply here. Each one has its own requirements, and each one is different. I believe that the statute has matured a great deal since the initial act in 1940. Where there may have only been several sections, now there are multiple, or there are more sections than there used to be. There are more independent protections in the statute to benefit the service member. That's the basis of the just cause argument. Now, if we move on beyond that, Your Honor, so if we go into the state law provision, which I would like to spend at least a little bit of time on, Section 5105, I believe that the General Assembly's use of the term terms and conditions of employment, because of when the statute was enacted in 1941, it's a different phrase than was used in the federal statute at that time. There are certain types of escalator protections in the federal statute where the escalator applies in some instances, it does not apply in others. The seniority benefits is one area, and the non-seniority benefits is another area, different sections of the statute where the extent of escalator protection varies. 5105 doesn't use the terms that the federal statutes use. It simply says terms and conditions of employment. And I believe that one of the terms and conditions of Corporal Janowski's employment when he was put on probation was that, or when he went out on active duty, was that he was on probation. And according to the plain text of 5105, that is to be continued as if he never left. That is a separate and independent basis to do such a thing. 5105, it is a unique statute. Not all states have it. A lot of states don't have the equivalent of Section 905 either. Delaware is one of the few states which has actually passed such a statute, which gets one around the 11th Amendment immunity problems, which are inherent in this type of legislation.
You are now in your rebuttal time. Did you want to save it?
I would like to.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the Court, my name is Jennifer Oliva. I'm the Deputy State Solicitor. At council table with me is Patricia Davis Murphy. She's a Deputy Attorney General, and we are here on behalf of the Delaware State Police. As I'm sure the Court is well aware, there are only two ways that a state loses its sovereign immunity. Either the federal Congress abrogates a state's sovereign immunity, and that's on very narrow grounds, or the state itself waives its sovereign immunity. The text and the structure and the amendments of USERRA demonstrate that those are the only two ways and recognize the federal case law that have established these two ways. As we lay out in our briefs, USERRA was amended quite generously in 1998 in response to a line of federal cases that clarified what sovereign immunity meant for states when sued in their own courts under the 11th Amendment and their own state constitutions. In 1997, there was a Seventh Circuit case called Velazquez, which decided that states could not be sued under the 11th Amendment to the federal constitution in federal district courts. The USERRA provision at issue at the time provided for the venue of federal district courts for any suit brought by any employee against a state employer. The Seventh Circuit struck that provision down as unconstitutional under the Supreme Court's former decision in the Seminole Tribe versus Florida case. So the statute was amended. Now USERRA, if you look at the jurisdictional and venue provisions, do not say that a state may be sued in federal district court. In fact, there's no such provision. USERRA provides two jurisdictional and two venue provisions. The first is, the United States, in a related action, may sue on behalf of an employee, a state, in federal district court. And it's well settled that the United States can bring suit against the state and its own courts. The second jurisdictional provision is that states, employees may sue states in state court so long as that's consistent with that state's law. That's consistent with the Seminole Tribe case. That's consistent with the 1999 decision in Alden versus Maine, where the state probation officers attempted to sue the state of Maine, their employer, under the Fair Labor Standards Act. And that case went up to the United States Supreme Court, which held two things. First, that it was correct that those defendants had been dismissed from federal district court when they originally brought their claim, because you can't sue a state in federal district court under Article I legislation. And secondly, it held, more important to this case, that you can't sue a state in its own courts under Article I legislation. So what we're left with is the possibility of waiver, because there can be no abrogation under the clear and consistent case law, as well as USERRA's recognition post-1998 of that case law and its new jurisdiction and venue provisions. So we look to the Delaware Constitution. Article 1, Section 9 of the Delaware Constitution says, suits may be brought against the state according to such regulations as shall be made by law. That provision codified in the first Delaware Constitution the common law of Delaware at the time. It's been in every Delaware Constitution since then and is, of course, in the current Constitution. This Court has interpreted that provision to mean sovereign immunity can only be waived by an express and clear statement by the General Assembly. Each and every case in sovereign immunity in the state of Delaware that this Honorable Court has decided has said that. Thus, Mr. Janowski must point to a state statute that either expressly or clearly waives sovereign immunity. And specifically, sovereign immunity to the claims that he raises in his complaint and to the agency, the state agency, that he has sued in his complaint.
Well, does it have to have the phrase waive sovereign immunity in order for there to be a waiver?
No, sir, it does not. In fact, I'd be happy to go through the cases. I'm going to show there's three or four ways this Court's been quite consistent where you've recognized a waiver, and I can move right to that. I was going to start with the Murphy versus CMS case, which was decided by Judge Abelman, and the interesting thing about that case is she sort of lays out some of this court's prior precedents. So I'd like to go through that if you don't mind, Your Honor. First of all, this court has said you need a compelling legislative statement that's expressed and clear. In Murphy, which is a Delaware Superior Court case that was decided in 2005, Judge Abelman, who wrote the opinion, noted that there were three claims against the state defendant, Department of Corrections: a gross negligence claim, a simple negligence claim, and a claim that the corrections department had violated a state statute which in effect requires it to establish health care services for anybody in the care of its prisons throughout the state. The plaintiff had brought a claim arguing that CMS and DOC had violated his constitutional rights and then the state law claims by providing him substandard medical care when he had a stroke while in DOC custody. Mr. Murphy argued that DOC could not raise the sovereign immunity defense to those claims because the General Assembly had waived sovereign immunity in enacting the State Torts Claims Act, which is found at 10 Delaware Code 4001. It's a very broad act, and I know the justices are all familiar with it, but it says that the state employees are liable for their actions that sound in tort unless three things are present. Those actions arose during their official duties, they were done in good faith, and they were done without gross or wanton negligence. And as I mentioned already, Mr. Murphy had brought a gross negligence claim against DOC. But Judge Abelman wrote, and I quote, "Despite its seemingly broad language, both the Delaware Supreme Court and the federal courts have held that the State Torts Claim Act does not by itself waive sovereign immunity whenever that three-part test is not met. Instead, there must be statutory evidence that the state intended to waive its sovereign immunity for a particular agency." For this proposition, she cited to this court's case in Sand versus the Delaware Solid Waste Authority. There, the Solid Waste Authority was held to not be able to bring the claim, or the defense, excuse me, of sovereign immunity. It had been waived by the General Assembly. How so? Because when the General Assembly enacted the Delaware Solid Waste Authority's enabling legislation, it put a provision in there that gave it the power to sue and be sued. And that's exactly what the provision says. This court also noted further that the agency had purchased insurance to cover the exact kind of claims, there were negligence claims in that case, that had been brought against it. In case after case that Judge Abelman cites in her opinion in Murphy, she says you have to have certain things in place for the court to decide that there's a waiver. It can't just be pointing to the State Torts Claims Act, which, by the way, applies to the state, defines the state as the entity at issue, unlike the statute at issue here. She says you need language like the power to be sued or be sued. It doesn't have to say waiver or sovereign immunity to answer the question, but you have to have...
You don't disagree with your opponent's definitions of any.
I don't, Your Honor, think that the operative word at issue in this case is the word any. I think the operative word at issue in this case is the word employer. There's many, many Delaware statutes that use the word a employer, the employer, an employer, any employer. The issue is what do they mean by employer? And that's why case after case, the Whistleblower Act of Tony versus Sharp case is an excellent example of this. The Superior Court in 2005 in that case went and looked at the definition of the word employer and said, the definition of the word employer in that statute explicitly says any department, agency, subdivision of the state, explicitly. So it said an employer may be sued by an employee. What are we talking about when we say employer and employee? They went to the definition section, and they saw that employer means agency, department, division, et cetera, of the state. I commend to the court, and I've looked quite thoroughly at this, that there's no case that this court or any of the inferior courts in Delaware have ever decided where they've said employer equals a certain thing, so we don't have that. They always go to the statute and look to see whether or not it's ambiguous and if there's a definition. There's no sovereign immunity case in this jurisdiction where the word state is not used on the face of the statute explicitly.
In that definitional section, is it limited to that context? Does it say for purposes of this statute only?
It says this subdivision, I believe, or subsection, Your Honor. But I have it right here and I can read it to you.
Don't read it to me. I'll accept
it. I believe it says this subsection in that statute. In sum, all the cases that this court's decided or affirmed have made it absolutely clear that sovereign immunity is never waived in Delaware unless, one, it's absolutely clear that the General Assembly meant the state. it must be on the face of the statute. And I give the example of the Whistleblower Act and the State Tort Claim Act. And even though it's on the face of the State Tort Claim Act, you still need another statute with an insurance provision or something to that effect. So it's been very narrowly construed. Or two, the word sue and to be sued appear in the particular agency's enabling statute. That's sort of the survey of the case law in the state on this issue. Other indications the court often points to is purchase of insurance under the State Insurance Protection Act, which is found at 18 Delaware Code 6511. I'd also point this court to its recent decision on certification from the Superior Court in Shepherd versus the Department of Health and Social Services. It's a 2004 case. Many state defendants were involved in that case. Some of the agencies included the Delaware Psychiatric Center. There was a suicide, unfortunately, at the psychiatric center, and the estate of the individual brought numerous claims, including gross negligence against DPC. The question that was certified to this court was, does gross negligence waive sovereign immunity under the State Tort Claims Act? This court said, no, it does not, without anything more. It went on and looked for an insurance provision under 6511, the provision I just mentioned, and said, and I quote, an insurance-dependent provision 18 Del Code 6511 does not waive sovereign immunity under these circumstances because there was no insurance in place to cover the alleged loss. More importantly, perhaps for our purposes here, because we can draw an important analogy, the court went on and said the following. Similarly, the mental health patient's Bill of Rights does not expressly waive sovereign immunity because the statute does not contain any language that expresses that intention explicitly or implicitly, and then the court cites to 16 Delaware Code 5161 and 5162. Now, the Mental Health Patients Bill of Rights is an interesting statute because it's structurally very similar to USERRA. What it says in its enforcement provision is either the Attorney General can bring a claim on your behalf or any interested citizen can enforce it. That's in 5162. Any of the provisions of 5161 are going to say the Attorney General can enforce it or any interested citizen can enforce it. Then when you go to 5161, you see that it applies to any hospital or facility, including, of course, why the claim was brought in that particular case. If you want to read any hospital, means any state hospital, any federal hospital, etc. I think that statement is really important in this particular case because it demonstrates that the court wasn't hung up on the term any hospital or facility. It was looking for an express waiver of sovereign immunity, and there was none on the face of the statute. There's no insurance provision to cover those sorts of negligence claims that might arise, and that's how the court came out in Shepherd. In my view, Shepherd is dispositive of how the court should decide this particular case. Furthermore, if any employer really meant any employer, which it does not, it would also include, theoretically at least, federal employers. USERRA does not allow a suit against a federal employer unless it's done in a very particular way, and that's because that's a matter of federal law, obviously. You can't sue the post office under USERRA in Delaware State Court, and you can't sue the post office in Delaware State Court under Section 905, and there's obvious reasons for that. So any employer doesn't mean any employer. That goes too far. This court does not get hung up on the words an employer, any employer, the employer. It wants to know what did the General Assembly mean when it said employer. And I think that that's very obvious in the Mental Health Patients Bill of Rights context. I'd also add that that statute is certainly a statute that would be considered remedial since it outlines numerous rights for people in the custody or care of a state facility who have mental illnesses, down to including rights of be free from restraints, get certain examinations, things like that. It's explicit for section after section after section lays out the very specific rights that those folks have. So the Mental Health Patients Bill of Rights is quite analogous in my view to USERRA in the sense that USERRA sort of lays out the benefits that returning service members are entitled to by their civilian employers. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for any rebuttal or I'd take any questions.
The issue is, rebuttal is for the appellant. This is your chance to say what it is.
I'm going to use the rest of my time, Your Honor.
Use it or lose it.
Use it or lose it.
People would say.
Yes, sir. Does the court have any questions? If not, then I'd just briefly like to address the justice's questions about the B6 claims that are still outstanding.
Please do.
Yes, sir. The first claim that Mr. Janowski made under B6 was that he was entitled to have his probation run while he was abroad serving in the Delaware National Guard. There is no provision that Mr. Janowski can point to, and he hasn't, as was demonstrated in the earlier questioning, that provides for such a provision. We had a fairly extensive discussion on the record with Judge Young about this, and the bottom line is that probation is told, or one court has come out otherwise on this, but the rest of the courts are consistent. If the Delaware State Police had sent him, he'd gone off to serve the country, and he was on probation for 2 or 3 weeks, and he came back, and the time was served, and he went back on the road, there would be absolutely no way for the state police to determine whether or not he had learned the skills that he was negligent in before and decide whether or not to take him off probation or take any further corrective action. That puts the employer in an extremely bad position.
Well, would you answer one question in that respect?
Yes, sir.
What is the difference between that as status and eligibility for promotion as status? There's equally no opportunity for the employer to compare the service member's absence from employment with someone who has remained to be employed to determine whether or not someone merits promotion. How is that distinguishable?
That's an excellent question, Your Honor. The terms and benefits, I think the first thing is that he brings this claim under the terms and benefits section primarily, and a term of benefit of employment in DSP is not being able to violate the rules and regulations and being subject to disparate treatment by not having to serve sort of probation or corrective remedies under that. So we would say that that's not, being able to ignore those rules and regulations, the search procedures, the frisk procedures, et cetera, that doesn't fall into that. Seniority provisions generally are accepted under employment law as a term and benefit of employment. You sign a contract, you have a collective bargaining agreement, automatically at a certain year time frame, you get ratcheted up. The Delaware State Police doesn't have any such provision, as we argue in our briefs, and that doesn't apply. But a company or a state or an entity that did, that would be different because it is a benefit that you're being told when you sign that contract or you sign on the line for that company you have. You're also being told you have to follow the rules and regulations. He had to follow the Delaware State Police's rules and regulations. They had to give him the terms and benefits of his employment. They didn't have to allow him to violate those rules and not be treated similarly to other people. So in my mind, I agree with your point that it is difficult to assess somebody when they're away, but we give them the time, we count the time, they were on good behavior when they left, and if they had gotten served that extra year, they would have, under these escalators, they would have automatically gotten some sort of promotion or pay benefit or additional leave or vacation or whatever it happened to be. USERRA does protect that. And I think that's the difference.
Do you wish to address his point about no refresher course in search procedures, though he requested one?
Your Honor, that's a factual issue, in my view, that we're not on a motion for summary judgment here. The state police obviously disagrees with how that went down. He did get, we did say in our briefs that his supervising sergeant.
One way of addressing it is to say that it's a material fact in dispute. Is that your basic response?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Any other questions? You have anything further?
No, sir.
Thank you very much.
Now, Your Honors, focusing on the 905 issue, just to reiterate, I don't think it can get any more clear than using the phrase any employer. But if there is doubt about that, we do go to the in pari materia argument. I don't believe that Section 905 can reasonably be read without looking at the statutes that 905 actually refers to, any state or any other state or federal law affecting reservist rights. On its face, USERRA applies to states and state agencies. On its face, Section 5105 applies to public employees of the state. Not because Section 905 actually references other statutes, I believe that it would be an unreasonable interpretation to read it without looking at those statutes. When one does look, one sees that they do apply to public employers. And I believe that is a cornerstone of our sovereign immunity argument on appeal.
Would you address the points made by your colleague first about the focus should be on the word employer and not the word any? And secondly, the application or by analogy of the Mental Patients Bill of Rights?
Sure. As to the focus on the, I think that only affects argument one of our argument. Because the Mental Health Patients Bill of Rights, because that entire statute was passed later, I believe my understanding is it's a relatively recent statute. I could be off on that. But this statute itself was passed in the 1950s. The fact that the legislature has not amended it, as one of the justices indicated during my opening, I think that is significant. Your Honor, the imperi materia argument takes care of that. Even if we were to assume for the purposes of argument that the emphasis should be on employer, because Section 905 still refers to other statutes that are on the books, one has to look at those statutes. And when one does, one sees that they do apply to public employers. Therefore, one could even take out the first sentence of Section 905, the sentence which refers to any employer, and still reach the same result that sovereign immunity is waived. Okay. Now, as to the defense argument regarding the Alden case, I don't contend that USERRA waives or abrogates state sovereign immunity under the 11th Amendment or anything like that. My argument is entirely dependent upon Section 905. I believe that law is clear. Alden did do that, but that's not an issue with us, Your Honor. We are not arguing that.
You've mentioned that this statute goes back to 1950. I take it your research found no other case other than this one where a public employee brought a claim against the state.
That is correct. I looked quite a bit and couldn't find anything. I believe this is the first time the statute has been interpreted, unless there's an unreported opinion that Westlaw doesn't have on it. I came up with nothing. Now, the defense also argued as to the tolling of the probationary period, indicating that only one court has ruled that the tolling of probation, that the tolling of a probationary period violates the benefit of employment section of USERRA, and indicated that other courts have said the opposite. Only one court has ever addressed the probation issue, Your Honor, and that's the Schmalk case. No case has ever come down on the disciplinary probation other than Schmalk. And Schmalk said that tolling a probationary period does violate the section of the benefit of employment section, section 4311. I believe that is the only case out there. There's not a lot of case law out there on this, Your Honor. This is an issue of first impression in a lot of ways. This may be an issue of second impression on the 4311A argument as to the benefit of employment. Unless the court has any other questions, I could say more, but I'd be saying everything I've already said.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for a very interesting argument. I certainly agree this is a case of first impression, which has significant interest, I think, to the community at large. Thank you for an excellent argument. We'll stand in recess and take the case under advisement.